This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll talk with Katie Gallagher from the Center for Constitutional Rights as she attends the Rachel Corey trial in Israel.
7 years later, the family of Rachel Corey is still trying to get justice against the state of Israel for her murder. Listen to Katie as she talks to us about the trial from Haifa, Israel.
You can't be president. The outrageous barriers to democracy in America. We're delighted to have with us today John Rick MacArthur, the president and publisher of Harper's Magazine. Rick grew up outside of Chicago, is intimately familiar with the Chicago Democratic machine that produced Obama. We're going to be speaking with him today about a balance sheet of the last 2 years of the Obama administration.
Stay with us. What updates do we have this week?
Heidi, a few months ago, we interviewed Lee Gelertner from the ACLU about a significant case called Ashcroft v. Al-Kid, or Al-Kid v. Ashcroft. Abdullah Al-Kid, who was born in Kansas, was once a star football player at the University of Idaho, spent 16 days in federal detention on what's called a material witness warrant. He was completely innocent of anything. This is about 2003, I think. He was treated as if he was the worst terrorist, stripped naked, put into isolation, kept for 16 days under what's called a material witness warrant. A material witness warrant is a legal procedure that allows the government to hold a witness if that person, for example, has seen a crime and might flee and not appear at the trial. During the post 9/11 period, continuing today as far as I know, government has been misusing these material witness warrants to simply pick up people who they have the vaguest suspicion might be involved in some criminal act or terrorism, but they don't have enough evidence to actually arrest them. So they're essentially using it as a preventive detention holding procedure. And that's what they did to Al-Kid. Al-Kid eventually was freed, and he brought a lawsuit against the Attorney General Ashcroft. And an amazing decision in the circuit court, a 2-1 decision, held that he had the right to sue Attorney General Ashcroft personally for misusing the material witness warrant. In other words, instead, this guy was no, a kid was not a witness to any crime or anything. They just said, well, we want to just investigate this guy, so let's pick him up and throw him in the slammer. And let's not just pick him up and throw him in a regular slammer. Let's put him into three different states, transfer him around, keep him in isolation, and keep him naked. So he sues, and amazingly, the circuit, he wins 2-1, saying Ashcroft can be sued personally for misusing the warrant. It's a remarkably important decision, and one that we were pretty sure when we did the interview with Lee, the government would appeal to the Supreme Court, and they did. And unfortunately, the Supreme Court granted review of that case. I say unfortunately. Of course, they could uphold the decision of the circuit, but the chances of that, I mean, I won't say they're zero on this program, but they're low. With that court, with that issue, and with the idea that they're essentially protecting every government official that comes across the bar of the court from anything, whether it's torture, misuse of material witness warrant, et cetera.
Michael, which circuit was this in?
It was a Ninth Circuit decision. And actually, after the case was won 2-1 by Al-Kid, the government petitioned for an on-bank hearing in the entire Ninth Circuit, which is maybe, I don't know, it was 18 or 20 judges. 8 judges of the court dissented from the denial of an on-bank hearing, saying, we want an on-bank hearing. So there's tremendous hostility to this decision.
To explain to listeners, if they had an on-bank hearing, likely this fine decision would have been reversed.
I think that's correct. It would have been. And what the judge said, who wrote the decision in the Ninth Circuit, he said, to use a material witness statute pretextually in order to investigate or preemptively detain suspects without probable cause is to violate the Fourth Amendment. And the Fourth Amendment bans unreasonable searches and seizures. So this case really strikes at the heart of the whole question of when can a person be arrested. What the judge said in the circuit was you can't arrest a person without probable cause. You can't use a material witness warrant as a pretext for doing so. And now our wonderful Supreme Court is going to be taking on this decision. I don't think it bodes well.
Michael, what do you think of the new don't ask, don't tell policy?
Well, there was a recent federal court decision, Heidi, that was terrific. A federal court judge said that the law, the regulations, and essentially memoranda supporting it, what we call don't ask, don't tell, was unconstitutional. That it was a violation of due process that you couldn't let go of people in the military or get rid of them or give them discharges just because they were gay, lesbian, etc. So it's a remarkably good ruling, and we're all excited about it. The problem with the ruling, of course, is Obama, who has claimed repeatedly that the policy is discriminatory, he said it again and again, has decided to ask the court and then the appeals court for a stay of the ruling so it isn't implemented right away. And then he's planning to appeal the ruling. So let's think about that. A federal judge basically issues an order saying a particular statute is unconstitutional. The Obama administration, which says this statute is discriminatory, and also in which the House of Representatives has also voted to repeal the statute. The Senate hasn't taken any vote yet. It hasn't gotten to the floor. The Obama administration says we're not only going to appeal, we're going to ask for a stay. The positive thing that's happened since then is the Pentagon, because there's no stay given and the federal judge refused to give a stay, they'll have to go to the Court of Appeals now. They now have a policy. They've just changed it as of this week to say that they will no longer toss people from the military or refuse to recruit them into the military because they're gay. One interesting thing about the statute, I finally went back and read the statute, and it's a long, usual BS statute with all kinds of clauses about how important military readiness is and all this junk. But I never realized what the statute said. The statute basically allows someone to be, let's say, quote, caught in a homosexual, as they refer to it in the statute, act, but still allows them to be kept in the military if, and this is what I can't get over, if you're caught like that, if you've engaged in or attempted to engage in or solicited others to engage in a homosexual act, you can still be kept if, A, such conduct is a departure from the member's usual and customary behavior. If you just do an occasional homosexual act, you can still be kept, or, it looks like an order to me, such conduct is unlikely to recur. Maybe all of them have to occur. Such conduct was not accomplished by the use of force, and under the particular circumstances, the member does not have a propensity or intent to engage in homosexual acts. So it's completely bizarre. I couldn't.
It has nothing to do with human sexuality or psychology to start with. It's bizarre.
So one night stands are allowed.
One night stands is allowed. How many are allowed? I don't know. You could even conceivably have a week stand and still stay in there. But when you see what Obama did, you know, I've read both New York Times pieces on this. The Times reporter says their government is appealing. In the first article, he said because they're required to, because they're defending a law of Congress.
Think about that.
So one of the justifications for Obama's request for, presumably, both a stay as well as an appeal here is that it's the obligation or the necessity or somehow the Justice Department is supposed to defend acts of Congress when they're held unconstitutional, because they are an act of the political branches that are signed by the president. The first New York Times coverage of this said that the Department of Justice was required to appeal these cases. Obviously, they got letters about that because you're not required to. There's many circumstances where they aren't required to or there's no requirement at all, but where traditionally they haven't. The article that I just read about it now says they've traditionally appealed cases that in which a statute is held unconstitutional. But even that, to me, would be very subject to what this case is actually about. First, you have 70% of the country saying they think this policy is just BS. Secondly, you have the president who says it's discriminatory, essentially saying it's unconstitutional, the House, rather, now saying that it should be repealed. The Senate, it hasn't been brought to a floor vote. So you have a situation now that is different than a normal case in which, you know, there's a statute of Congress held unconstitutional. The president doesn't think it's unconstitutional. Both houses of Congress say, this is our statute, go with it. In this case, this is really Obama. That's what this is. And someone told me, and I'd be interested in the reaction of my two hosts here, and I criticized this policy the other day. Someone said, well, look, this is the deal, Michael. Obama wants to get us out of Afghanistan. The Pentagon does not want to have don't ask, don't tell
implemented, and the deal here is that Obama will continue to fight for Don't Ask, Don't Tell, even though he doesn't like the policy, as a deal for the Petraeus to agree to get out of Afghanistan. I'll take reactions from either of you, and we'll end this little update. What if this guy heard this inside?
How do you
inside?
Know what's inside of his head? All you can do is judge him on what he's doing, which is not good.
That was my answer. You're judging on what he's doing, and whether or not the Pentagon is trying to hold up our withdrawal from Afghanistan, and they are very powerful, based on this upholding the Don't Ask, Don't Tell, is completely, it seems like a non sequitur to me. It doesn't make any sense. And that Obama is strong enough to say, look, we're pulling out of Afghanistan, assuming that were ever the case, because we have to, and Don't Ask, Don't Tell, you know, is separate. But
well, Heidi, let me ask you a question. What do you think of the notion people, whatever their sexuality is, wanting to go into an imperial army?
Because I'm a pacifist and I don't believe in the military, and particularly in a militarist country that has the most, spends the most money on the military. I'm not really in favor of beefing up their forces to continue to kill people in Iraq and Afghanistan.
Rachel Corrie, an American student activist and human rights defender from Olympia, Washington, was crushed to death on March 16, 2003, by a Caterpillar D9R bulldozer while nonviolently protesting Palestinian home demolitions with fellow members of the International Solidarity Movement. The first phase of the trial began last March when the Corrie family presented its witnesses, including several of Rachel's colleagues from the ISM who witnessed her killing. During the second phase of the trial, which began last month, the government presented several witnesses, including the Israeli military police investigator who headed the investigation into Rachel's death and the bulldozer operators who struck and killed her. The lawsuit charges that Rachel's killing was intentional. It also charges that the Israeli government was negligent for allowing Israeli soldiers and military commanders to act recklessly using an armored military bulldozer without regard to the presence of unarmed, nonviolent civilians in Rafah, which is in the Gaza Strip. Lastly, the lawsuit alleges that the Israeli military failed to take appropriate and necessary measures to protect Rachel's life in violation of obligations under Israeli and international law. We're joined by Center for Constitutional Rights attorney Katie Gallagher, who was at the trial in Israel.
Katie Gallagher, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
You're in Haifa, Israel right now, and you're there to attend and work with, I guess, the Corries with regard to their case, the Rachel Corrie case against the State of Israel for the unlawful killing of Rachel Corrie in Rafah, Gaza. So can you give us a sense of that trial has been going on, what's it about, and what are you there for?
Sure. So back in March 2005, at the suggestion of the U.S. State Department, the Corrie family, including both Rachel's parents and her siblings, filed a civil case against the State of Israel. And in that case, they raised claims of intentional or, in the alternative, negligent killing of Rachel Corrie in Rafah. Rachel had been serving as a peace activist with the Palestinian International Solidarity Movement back in March 2003 when she was crushed to death by a Caterpillar bulldozer driven by an IDF soldier. We are hearing the testimony of the driver of that bulldozer.
Wasn't there a first phase of the trial a few months ago?
Yes, the case has unfortunately taken quite a while. As I said, it was filed back in 2005, and then the evidentiary phase opened in March 2010. And at that point, the Corries were able to call their own witnesses. Over the course of 2 weeks in March, they called several eyewitnesses to the killing of Rachel. They also called an expert who could speak about how to conduct a proper investigation. Mr. Corrie testified in the case, and critically, an Israeli military police investigator testified, and his testimony revealed really huge errors in the way this investigation was carried out.
Give us some sense of what those errors were.
Well, something as basic as the fact that the bulldozer was removed from the scene of the crime directly after the killing. There were investigators in the case who never went to the scene of the crime. Video footage that was taken of the scene was not reviewed by some members of the investigation team, and others didn't even ask for the footage to review until the week after the killing.
Tell us a bit about what the justice system is like there. Is it a jury system? Is this just before a judge?
Yeah, this case is being heard before a single judge, Judge Oded Gershon, in the Haifa court.
Now, this judge issued some kind of an order regarding a screen, and I think the driver of the bulldozer who is going to be examined, is he going to be behind a screen, or are you going to see him?
Yes, unfortunately, on October 7th, right before testimony was supposed to start of some of the State of Israel's key witnesses, a motion went in and asked that soldiers involved in the incident be allowed to testify from behind a screen. And they said that not even the family of Rachel Corey should be able to see these people as they testify.
What's wrong with putting somebody behind a screen? And can you do that in the United States?
You can have protective measures in the United States for witnesses, but this is really an extraordinary step insofar as the family, the plaintiffs in this case, are unable to see, you know, those soldiers who can provide some answers, even through their body language, through their facial expressions as they testify. So it is a pretty extraordinary step, and I think for the Coreys, who have been waiting 7.5 years to receive some answers, the fact that they won't be able to assess the credibility of the witness by examining his body language tomorrow is a significant blow.
So tomorrow is going to be a day in which the driver who actually drove the bulldozer over Rachel Corey testifies?
Yes, yes. And one thing that's notable, other witnesses have testified that when this bulldozer driver was giving his initial statement, you know, back after the incident happened, the killing happened back in 2003, the head of the Southern Command actually ordered that testimony, that statement be stopped and told the bulldozer driver not to cooperate with the investigation. Two witnesses, I believe, so far have testified to that fact.
Tell us, Katie, about what kind of public attention this case is getting there. Is the media on this?
It certainly has received some attention in Israel. I believe there will be a significant media presence tomorrow at the courthouse. From what I understand, the courtroom can hold about 30 people, and it's expected to be a very, very full hearing. And you know that not maybe everyone who wants to see it can attend, but certainly when you say the name Rachel Corey in Israel, people know who she is. And when you say it, I was in the West Bank yesterday, and when you say it there, people certainly know who she is as well. But I think what's significant is it's also received international attention. It's received attention in the United States, as it should, when we're talking about the death of a U.S. citizen that so far has led to no accountability and very few answers.
So we're going to have one day of testimony, and then what happens in the trial? Are we going to be talking to you again in a couple months, or is it the trial going to come to a conclusion soon?
Well, there are still a few more witnesses to testify. Unfortunately, the judge hearing the case had a death in the family, so two trial dates scheduled for earlier this week were canceled. So I think we'll be hearing when those dates will be rescheduled, but hopefully early in November, and this case can conclude soon thereafter. In terms of how long it will take until we have a decision and a judgment, I don't know. I can only say I hope it's soon, because the Coreys, again, have been waiting for many, many years.
When I've had the opportunity to listen to Rachel Corey's parents here in the United States, I was really struck about what extraordinary people they are. Have they been able to speak out in Israel? Have they gotten any voice?
They have, I believe, done at least one television interview. They've been quoted in a number of local papers and also have done a number of interviews with international press here. So I think the one live interview they did on a very important television station here in Israel helped Israelis see just who the Coreys are, because I agree with you, they're absolutely incredible people who are not seeking anything along the lines of vengeance in this case. They're simply asking for answers.
The case is brought on behalf of whom against whom?
Okay, the case was filed by the estate of Rachel Corey, her parents Craig and Cindy, and her brother Chris and her sister Sarah. So Sarah and both her parents are here to attend the trial tomorrow. And it was filed against the State of Israel, the Ministry of Defense.
So it's not filed against individuals, but the actual state.
Yes, it's filed against the actual state. And among the defenses that the state has raised is that it should have immunity. It has declared the killing of Rachel an act of state because it occurred in a war zone.
Say that again, an act of state, right?
An act of state, that they should be immune from this case, although, of course, the case has proceeded to an evidentiary phase. And one thing that I find particularly disturbing is that the state of Israel has also argued that Rachel should be held accountable for her own death since she acted in reckless disregard of her own life. That's kind of a bare-bones outline of what the claims are in the case.
Katie, how are the Corys holding up under all of this with the delays and now the judge's death in the family?
You know, I think it's been hard. It's been a very, very long process, and they've been in Israel now since the end of August. So it's been a long time, and I hope that when the new court hearings are scheduled, it can be as soon as possible so that this process can be concluded. And, of course, I think tomorrow's testimony, the testimony of the man who drove the bulldozer that killed her, is a very challenging day for them. The day they've waited for, it's a day they've wanted, but I think it's certainly going to be a challenging day. This has been a trying process.
In terms of liability of the state of Israel, there's, I guess one question is, was it an intentional killing? Did the driver or someone who ordered him to keep going see Rachel Corey there and just said, heck with it, I'm driving over her? Was it the equivalent of an intentional killing, or was it negligence in some way? And I guess the Corys are raising both issues, or I'm not sure.
Yeah, no, they are raising both issues in the alternative. So their first line is that it was an intentional killing, that the driver, you know, you have to remember that the ISM observers, including Rachel, had been in Gaza, in Rafah, in front of the Nasrallah house, protesting its destruction, its demolition by these bulldozers for most of the day. So they had been there for hours in their fluorescent jackets with these two bulldozer drivers, seeing them throughout the course of the day. So the argument is that when she was run over, it was at the end of a day that the drivers knew she was there, knew the other observers were there, and she was intentionally driven over. And yes, in the alternative, they've argued that it's a negligent killing. It reflects gross negligence in the training, in the use of armored bulldozers, particularly in areas where you have civilians present, unarmed civilians. So that's the second theory of liability.
Now, Rachel was a part of the ISM, you said. That's the International Solidarity Movement, right?
Yes, it is.
When you start talking about the bulldozers, the Center for Constitutional Rights had a case against Caterpillar for making special kind of bulldozers that essentially are house demolition killer bulldozers. Can you just give us quickly what happened in that case in the United States?
Sure. Back in March 2005, that the same time that the case in Israel was filed, CCR, along with counsel in Seattle, filed a case on behalf of the Corey family, Rachel's parents, as well as Palestinian families who had also lost family members or had their homes destroyed. And that case was filed against Caterpillar, which is based in Illinois. And the theory of that case was that Caterpillar, which has been unnoticed for literally decades, that its bulldozers were being used for house demolitions in violation of international law, that Caterpillar had aided and abetted war crimes and other serious violations of international law. Those other violations include the house demolitions, collective punishment, targeting of civilians, and the killing of civilians. Now, unfortunately, we lost that case in the Ninth Circuit, and we lost on the grounds that the case presented a non-justiciable political question. And the way the Ninth Circuit reached that conclusion is that the Caterpillar bulldozers, which were sold directly from Caterpillar to the Israeli Defense Force, Israel was reimbursed for the sale of those bulldozers by the United States government. So
that's
the Ninth
remarkable.
Circuit,
yeah.
The Ninth Circuit read into that reimbursement an affirmation of the purchase of these armored bulldozers and said that to allow this case to proceed would actually be questioning U.S. foreign policy decisions around aid to Israel, and that it was a political question, something the courts just couldn't look into.
There's a certain logic to that. $3 billion a year, you know, goes in for projects like this. You know what concerns me, Katie? The judge who's responsible, because there's no jury to decide the facts of the case as well as the law, the judge is allowed a screen to go up between him and the witness. How can the judge assess the negligence or willfulness of this bulldozer driver without even looking at him?
To clarify, the judge will be able to see the witness.
Oh.
It's the Corey family that will not be able to see the witness. So the lawyers representing the Coreys will actually be able to see the witness, as will the judge. But the Coreys and the rest of the courtroom, and I think that this is not a minor fact, certainly not for the Coreys, but I think also for the Israeli public and anyone else who's in the courtroom tomorrow, to be able to draw their own conclusions about the credibility of the witness, but not to worry about the judge not being able to see the witness. He will be able to.
Do they allow cameras in the courtroom there?
No, there aren't cameras that will be in the courtroom tomorrow. I don't know, as a general practice, whether there are ever cameras allowed in. So
I know you're in Israel primarily as an observer and person involved in the Corey trial, but I'm interested in if there's anything you want to say about what you've done in the last couple of days there. Like, for example, did you have to take an oath to the Jewish and Democratic State of Israel to get in? I'm referring, of course, to what may be required for citizenship in Israel now. But anyway,
yes.
I presume they don't give it to tourists or work visas at this point.
Not yet.
Not yet.
No, I did not have any difficulties getting in. But just the general comment, I would say, I lived in Jerusalem a number of years ago, and I spent yesterday walking around the city, and it just struck me how much that city has changed in the 18 years since my first trip there. There's just been a massive amount of construction in and around the old city, and particularly in East Jerusalem. So you really do physically see the changes to Jerusalem on the ground, and that was fairly disturbing and also pretty sad to see. So.
Well, do give the Coreys a big hug from all of us here. They're an incredibly brave and courageous family. And, of course, Rachel was that as well. So thank you very much for being with us, Katie.
You're welcome, and I'll pass that on for sure.
Thanks, Katie.
Good luck. Thanks a lot.
Take care.
Okay.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org. for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
Delighted to have with us today John Rick MacArthur, the president and publisher of Harper's Magazine. He's an award-winning journalist and author, most recently of the excellent book, You Can't Be President, The Outrageous Barriers to Democracy in America. Rick grew up outside of Chicago, is intimately familiar with the Chicago Democratic machine that produced Obama, and we're going to be speaking with him today about a balance sheet of the last 2 years of the Obama administration.
Welcome, Rick, to Law & Disorder.
Thanks for having me.
Rick, you grew up outside of Chicago. You kept your eye on the Daily Machine, the old man and now the current one. Part of your really wonderful book, You Can't Be President, The Outrageous Barriers to Democracy in America, talks about the Democratic Party in Chicago, the organization that gave birth to President Obama. now that we've had 2 years, almost, of President Obama, is what's your take on it? What kind of balance sheet would you draw? Were you surprised? Because I know a lot of people who were enthusiastic and supported him now feel betrayed and discouraged. Were you surprised at all about the trajectory of the Obama presidency? How do you gauge it now? Where do you think it's going? Where did it come from?
Well, there's two balance sheets. You have to look at the balance sheet as it regards the people of the United States. And then there's the other balance sheet, which I try to talk about in You Can't Be President, which is the internal party structure, the Democratic Party, how it functions, how it maintains power, how it crushes dissidents, and so on and so forth. Obviously, or I feel it's clear that on the first one, as it concerns the American people, the balance sheet is quite bad because we are now enmeshed in an even more self-destructive war, if possible, than Iraq was, and we haven't really withdrawn from Iraq. Afghanistan is a disaster, and you don't have to ask a peacenik to explain it to you. You can ask somebody as right-wing as Edward Luttwak, who's very good on the subject of the inanity and the self-destructiveness of Afghanistan, the waste of time and money and so on. You have fake health care reform, which really reinforced the power of the insurance companies, the private insurance companies. You have very feeble reform of Wall Street, which essentially says we will deal with these problems later. We'll ask the Federal Reserve and other bureaucrats to regulate the derivatives market and the commercial banks at a date to be named later. You have a continuation of anti-labor, orthodox, quote, free trade, unquote, policies. Remember Obama said he was going to do something about NAFTA during the Ohio primary. He announced very early in the administration that he wasn't going to touch NAFTA. You have the continued corruption of the lobby system in Washington. I think a lot of liberal Republicans voted for Obama in the vain hope, naive hope, that he would actually attack the lobby system. I don't know where they got this idea from, because coming from Chicago, if he attacked the lobby system, it would be like committing political suicide. The first thing he did when he got into office, or before he actually, before his first important nomination or appointment, was Rahm Emanuel as his chief of staff and patronage chief. Rahm Emanuel's job, essentially, besides maintaining discipline within the party and within the White House, is to reward the party's friends and punish the party's enemies. That's the way we do it in Chicago. That's the way the system works. And on fundraising, of course, people have forgotten that Obama, because he was able to raise some small contributions, broke every record in corporate fundraising, PAC fundraising. He raised money from just about anybody. He even went and raised money from Jack Abramoff's old law firm. Very few people know about this. It's in my book, but I got it from a Newsday story, actually. Very good story. And so in sum, he's been a sort of anti-reformer, anti-progressive, and he's been a kind of status quo figure in almost every realm that I can think of. Oh, I left out the environment. Why is Ken Salazar still Secretary of the Interior? Because he's from Colorado, and he's expected, along with all the other important cabinet members, to shake down the oil business and the coal business and the natural gas business for contributions to the party in the upcoming election.
We also left out civil liberties.
Oh, my goodness. I'm sorry.
But we don't have to belabor that.
Well,
our listeners know that it's just really been an extension channeling of Bush Cheney.
The reason I don't mention it, it's interesting you bring it up, is because the civil liberties lobby of which you and I are prominent members, is so small in the United States that you sort of forget about it, even if you work at it all the time. It's sort of like being against I don't know, the death penalty. It's even smaller than the death penalty, anti-death penalty lobby. People just don't pay attention. If you criticize Bush doing it, it's great. If you criticize Obama doing it, you could hear a pin drop. I just met with a guy who was in Afghanistan. I was just in Paris, and he just did a visit of the new Bagram prison. And he said, look, it's terrifying. It's terrifying. And you have to assume that torture is still going on inside the prison. It's run with Prussian-like or Nazi-like efficiency. He said, I guess he said German-like efficiency. And he said, it looks like our future.
Getting back to that city by Lake Michigan and the machine that it spawned, first Mayor Daley and then his son, Junior. We both grew up there and know what it's like. It wasn't a surprise to me the trajectory that the Obama administration has followed, knowing what kind of machine that he came out of. But talk about that for our listeners for a bit, would you, Rick?
Well, you have to understand the Chicago machine is the most powerful local machine in the country. It is almost Soviet in its monopoly on power. You have 49 aldermen out of the 50-person city council who are Democrats. Every important job in the city and the county generally is held by a Democrat. Daley and his family have been able to twice essentially pick the president, 1960 John Kennedy, and in this last time around pushing Obama over Clinton, which was a very, very interesting intra-party struggle because you had some people who were – like Rahm Emanuel, who were divided in their loyalties. But ultimately, the Chicago machine just brooks no dissidents. I mean, it just doesn't allow pluralism of any kind, of any importance. And the mayor of Chicago is sort of like the dictator of Chicago. And that's why I always found it strange and almost bizarre to hear people talk about Obama as if he could be a reformer, as if he sort of flew over, lived above or beyond or apart from ordinary politics, when in fact he came out of the most intolerant, most monopolistic, one-sided political machine in the country. To say that the machine has an ideology would be misleading. It doesn't really have an ideology. It has a system by which it maintains power. But it's a go-along, get-along kind of organization. So, you know, in the 90s when Clinton wanted NAFTA passed, he knew he needed help from recalcitrant Democrats because generally labor was against it, the big labor union. So he went for help to people like Richie Daley and his brother William. They're the ones, they're the unsung heroes, Dan Rostenkowski, they're the unsung heroes of getting Rahm Emanuel also was a chief lobbyist for the NAFTA crusade in the Clinton administration. They're the unsung heroes of the NAFTA victory for Clinton. Chicago and the machine had a great deal to do with crushing or blocking organized labor opposition and getting the thing passed. So the example I give in my book, which I think deserves much more attention, is of sort of the absolute, almost absolute control Daley has, is actually a story where there was a rare bit of opposition back in 2004, Walmart wanted to come into Chicago. And in like a lot of cities, there was resistance because they could see that Walmart would drive mom and pop businesses out of business. And Daley, of course, said, I want them in. Now, we don't know exactly why he wanted them in, but he wanted them in. So there was a fight. Jesse Jackson took a position against it, Jesse Jackson Sr. And the city council, for the first time in, I don't know, 18 years of Daley's mayoralty, rebelled, or enough of them said, we don't want Walmart. And if you want Walmart, the price for letting them in has to be a big box minimum wage bill. In other words, we'll impose on these big box stores at least a decent working minimum wage above the national minimum wage with some kind of health benefits. And it passed incredibly. Daley vetoed it. It was the first time he'd used his veto in 18 years. He'd never had to use his veto before because most of the votes are 45-5 or 49-1 or whatever. The pro-big box minimum wage people mounted a counterattack with some help from dissident labor union people who in Chicago rarely get out of line because they're also very much aligned with the power structure. And Daley beat back the veto override by about 3 votes. He twisted arms. He did whatever he had to do to stop it, and the veto override failed. Now, that's not the end of the story because in Chicago, they play hardball. In the next primary, aldermanic primary campaign, just about every important pro-big box minimum wage aldermen. Anybody who had dared to get out of line and oppose the mayor got a primary opponent. All of a sudden, they had a well-financed, in some cases articulate, primary opponent, some of whom were funded by Walmart or by the retail lobby. Now, not all of them won. Some of the people held on to their seats. Some of the Democrats held on to their seats. But the message was clear, and they dropped it. The big box minimum wage is gone as an issue in Chicago because nobody wants that kind of trouble, even the people who are trying to do the right thing. That's the way it works in Chicago, and that's the way Obama learned it. Now, the other crucial thing in Obama's biography that helps you understand the way he operates and why he comes out of the machine is his famous run against Bobby Rush, the former Black Panther. This is for Congress in 2000.
Yeah.
The conventional storyline is that Obama overreached. He was too ambitious. He was a young sort of almost hothead who wanted to make his name and ready to take a tremendous risk and lost big and was humiliated. And he learned from this humiliation. But the more plausible story, which is supported by David Ignatius of the Washington Post, is that the City Hall encouraged Obama to run against Rush to punish him for having dared to run a primary campaign against Daley in 1999. Again, this is the way it works in Chicago. So Obama does his job, gets creamed.
2-1.
2-1. Maybe he thought he had a chance. Maybe he deluded himself into thinking that he could win. But he was doing, as far as I can tell, as far as my reporting has shown, he was doing a favor to the Daily Machine, which was merely to send Rush a message. Don't get out of line. You don't run against me in a primary without paying some kind of price. This gives Obama tremendous credibility with the machine, I think, and launches him on his national career. At that point, everything's open to him. He's introduced all the big money.
Yeah.
He gets Daley's blessing tacitly at first and then eventually openly, because Daley endorsing Obama for president over Clinton before the primaries were over was huge, a huge political factor and very unusual. Actually, it was unprecedented. Daley had never endorsed a primary candidate for president.
You mentioned that one of the largest corporate contributors to Obama was National Amusements, Inc. Can you talk a bit about his relationship with the media?
Well, he's cozied up to all of them early on, including Murdoch. He took money from everybody. National Amusements, again, is Sumner Redstone.
Yes.
Yes. And It's a euphemism for all of his various subsidiaries. National Amusements sounds like
it's perfect, isn't it?
It sounds like an amusement park or a collection of sideshows or something. But it's deadly serious business. And I think Obama realized that if he was going to run for president, he was going to have to out fundraise the Clinton fundraising machine. In order to do that, he was going to have to hit up everybody that the Clintons hit up and hit them up harder. Once he starts to get credibility, partly thanks to the Daily Machine, partly thanks to his Illinois connections, which are considerable with Archer Daniels Midland and so on, companies like that, the other people at the other corporations who would have favored Hillary Clinton automatically think, we better hedge our bets here. So they start contributing to both. And there was a point at which Murdoch's contributions to his PAC contributions, because you can't say his individual, but his bundled contributions from his various entities was about 50-50 between Clinton and Obama. I mean, this is like, now you're talking protection racket. You're talking, I got to pay this guy to protect myself. If he wins, I've got to pay this one, her, in case she wins. And ultimately, Obama was able to get enough enthusiasm, enough popular enthusiasm, to carry the day. But without that money, you end up like Howard Dean. Without that kind of establishment, big PAC support and big party support, you end up like Howard Dean in Iowa, knocked out by some secretive amorphous 527, which I also talk about, 527 committee, which I talk about in my book. My favorite irony is that Robert Gibbs, Obama's press secretary, was the spokesman for the 527 committee that really knocked Dean out in Iowa back in 2004.
I have to hand it to you. You were very far-seeing. You conclude your book saying, I'm not hopeful about an Obama presidency, and you are absolutely right about that. And then in the last part of it, you say, absent a third party with a Lincoln at the head of it, or an authentic populist revolt from within the Democratic Party, it's hard to see a prompt end to the Iraq catastrophe and its anti-democratic effects, not to mention its immense cost in money and lives. And I suppose you'd go on to say what happened in Afghanistan and Pakistan. Where do we go from here? People came to you and said, Mr. MacArthur, we read Harper's Magazine. We like it a lot. We've read your book, You Can't Be President. Where do we go from here?
I wish somebody would give Obama a primary in 2012. That's what we do. As I said, it's what they do in Chicago. You're not happy with Obama? Give him a primary. I don't see why we can't organize or around an opposition candidate, raise some money, and put a scare into him. Right now, all you have is liberals saying, oh, my God, the Tea Party, they're horrible, and it's anything but Obama and so on and so forth. And meanwhile, they've got Rahm Emanuel, as I understand it, abusing them to their faces, saying you're idiots, you're fools, you don't understand politics. And they are intimidated by this kind of talk. Well, they want to be realists and pragmatists and so on. But the only thing these guys understand, Rahm and company, is votes and money and power and leverage. And unless you mount some kind of a serious campaign with real money and real votes behind it, they're never going to take you seriously. They just take full advantage of you. Say, come on, it's anybody but Obama. You want the Tea Party? Okay. Where we go from here, I suppose, is the loss of the House. I think Daley's quitting or deciding not to run for re-election in mayor is a huge – for marriage is a huge, huge event of immense significance, because what it means, I think, is that Daley – is quite disappointed in Obama. Now I'm getting to the second rendering of accounts. The first one was for the people. Second one is for the professional party leaders, the barons of the Democratic Party. And I think for the first time what you're seeing is disillusionment among the party leadership with Obama, because he hasn't delivered the goods. He's sort of off in a cloud somewhere doing policy think or making speeches or trying to be an intellectual or whatever. And they wanted him to deliver the 2016 Olympics to Chicago. They wanted Rahm to deliver more pork to Cook County in Illinois. Every state party bureaucracy, every state Democratic Party democracy feels it's been, I think, it's been shortchanged by Obama, that they're not paying enough attention to business. And I think Daley said to himself, look, I don't want to preside over the decline of Chicago. He's got a huge budget deficit. He sees them losing the House, which would be his last hope of getting bailed out, or seeing the majority, the Democratic majority, reduced to such a low level that he won't be able to get any more money out of Washington. Why stick around and be mayor and fiddle with budget cuts, negotiate with the unions, and so on and so forth? So he bails out and says, okay, you guys clean up the mess.
I think he's
disappointed with Obama, particularly failing on the Olympics. Do you remember what happened? He tried to send Michelle,
right?
And Michelle was going to go by herself. And obviously Valerie Jarrett or somebody got a call from City Hall saying, wait a minute, you were supposed to bring home the Olympics. That was going to be our ultimate bailout plan. you get yourself over there. And suddenly healthcare reform was not so urgent anymore, and Obama was on a plane to Copenhagen. Do you remember? And then he gets there. It's too late.
Yeah.
They hadn't counted the votes. They hadn't done the work. They hadn't done the basic spade work. You have to win that vote. He comes back humiliated. I mean, Chicago didn't even come close.
But I think there was one success could be chalked up, not by you, Rick, or Heidi, or me, or the people that listen to this show, but by the people that really own and run this country. I remember what Andrew Sullivan, the editor of Atlantic, said when he switched his allegiance and decided to support Obama. And he said, I woke up one morning and it dawned on me how great it would be for, say, a kid in Pakistan who wakes up one morning and he sees that Barack Hussein Obama has been elected president of the United States. And I thought, you know, for a bunch of young people in the United States, they'd think the same thing. And I think, you know, it would be really good, actually, if the powers that be supported a guy like this. And then Chris Buckley came over and he supported him. He lost his seat on the National Review because of it. David Brooks, the conservative columnist for the New York Times, supported him. I think they were articulating a point of view of the very rich and powerful in this country that Obama would be a good deflection of people's anger at the Bush administration. And I think in that respect, they were right. Obama has deflected things for 2 years. You know, they don't have any long-term plans. They see everything in the short. In the short term, they sidetrack things for 2 years.
It's not so bad for Obama personally. I think he enjoys being president. Somebody said to me he's having such a good time being president. Why should he be bothered with trying to govern the country in a positive way? And if he does lose the House, some very cold, cynical, realistic political tacticians have said to me it could be a good thing for him because he gets rid of Nancy Pelosi. She's not speaker anymore. She's kind of a thorn in his side, a sort of old-fashioned liberal bugging about Afghanistan and welfare and let's do something, for God's sake, let's do something. He's tired of hearing that from her, so she's swept away. And then he gets to run against the evil Republican majority in 2012. The Republicans put up some stumble bum or stumble, how do you say stumble bum in the feminine? A
stumble
Sarah Palin type or a Huckabee type or someone like that. And Obama wins re-election easily.
Yeah, that's what we call the two-party shell game.
Right. Right. By the way, I forgot to mention on the big box minimum wage, I hate to leave this out, Obama, and this is his political genius, he did not take a position on the big box minimum wage. And when I called his office and asked him why didn't he take a position, he said, well, it's not appropriate for a national candidate to take a position on a local issue. That is U.S. Senator. Of course not. It's only 3 million people in the biggest county in Illinois. The reason he didn't do it, as my sources told me, of course, is he didn't want to get on the wrong side of Daley. There's no way he's going to support that kind of thing to get Daley mad. But what's more interesting is that people sort of assumed and continue to assume that Obama would have supported something like that.
Yeah, they cut him a lot of slack.
He's a tremendously prudent, cautious politician. There's no audacity at all. It's the audacity of smoke or something. He goes real, real cautious. He plays by the rules. He doesn't take chances. I mean, it is, ambition is a weird thing. I mean, to take on the Clintons when it looked like she had it in the bag and they were clearly the most powerful fundraising organism in the party, that takes a certain boldness and audacity. But you have to step back a minute and say, wait a minute, he did it with the support of the most powerful barony in the country in terms of Democratic Party politics. That's the Cook County machine.
Absolutely.
So it's not that audacious. It's pretty audacious, not that audacious.
Absolutely.
The book is You Can't Be President, The Outrageous Barriers to Democracy in America by John R. MacArthur, and it's published by Melville House. So get a copy of this great book.
And subscribe to Harper's Magazine. You won't be sorry. Rick, thanks so much for being on Law and Disorder.
Thank you for having me.
Law and Disorder Radio is now on Facebook. Go to Facebook, friend us, tell your friends.